little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan.
Welcome to Thinking Clearly. This is a show about critical thinking and related topics, and my name is Bob Frelick, and I'm here with the other host of Thinking Clearly, Julia Minton. Hey, Julia.
Hi, Bob.
Julia, we're all ready to go with a couple of wonderful guests for this episode.
We heard from a listener who suggested that we pick up this book and check out the content, and so it led to us inviting the authors of the book, and we'll be hearing more from them in a bit.
And our guests for this episode, Jerry Graff and Kathy Berkenstein, are professional and intellectual partners, as well as husband and wife, and both served as faculty in the English department at the University of Illinois at Chicago, where they collaborated and at times co-taught courses until their retirement from teaching back in 2016. And other collaboration includes co-presenting more than 100 lectures and workshops at colleges and high schools, and co-authoring the highly acclaimed book, now in its sixth edition, which we're going to be focusing on here, titled They Say, I Say, The Moves That Matter in Academic Writing. And a little background, with a PhD in English and American Literature from Stanford University, Jerry Graff has a long and distinguished career, holding professorships at several universities, including the University of New Mexico, Northwestern University, the University of Chicago, and the University of Illinois at Chicago, where he also served as the Associate Dean for Curriculum and Instruction at the College of Arts and Sciences. And then in 2008, he served as president of the Modern Language Association, which a lot of students know as the MLA, Modern Language Association of America. Having started his teaching career back in 1963, folks can remember what was happening back in those days, dynamic cultural conflicts that were evident both in the streets and on campus, which no doubt influenced his personal philosophy, I'm willing to bet, and we might hear a little bit about that, and influenced his approach to teaching and inspired him to write books with titles like Beyond the Culture Wars, How Teaching the Conflict Can Revitalize American Education, and a book called Clueless in Academe, How Schooling Obscures the Life of the Mind. Now, these books and other writings certainly cemented the connection between his name and the phrase, teach the conflicts, which means, and this is a quote, staging the culture war debates that tend to rage behind the scenes for students and letting them decide for themselves what position to take. And for Kathy, she holds a bachelor's degree from Columbia College, Chicago, a master's degree from Northwestern University, and a PhD from Loyola University at Chicago. And Kathy Berkenstein has published a number of articles in professional journals. And in addition to her other collaborative work with Jerry, Kathy contributed the practice of using writing templates, which she used in her own teaching as a key element in the writing and thinking process is described in their book, They Say, I Say. Kathy Berkenstein and Jerry Graff, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, let's just dive right in. It looks like your first edition of They Say, I Say, published in 2006. Let's start by giving each of you an opportunity to talk about your motivation for writing that book and how your experiences and thinking shaped the content of They Say, I Say.
When Kathy and I first started to go out together, we were both teaching first-year writing courses and college courses, and we began to compare notes, and it turned out that we both agreed that practice of writing was being made to look too hard for students. Not that writing isn't hard and challenging, everybody knows that it is, but we felt that students were getting a lot of TMI, too much information. They were being overloaded with so much information. a lot of it quite good, some of it not so good. And we felt that students were often struggling to write because they couldn't cut through the clutter of all this information, good and bad. As we started talking about it, it turned out we both agreed that, yes, writing is very difficult, and there's certainly a lot of components to it, but that there is one fundamental thing that you need to do, especially, and we're talking now about persuasive writing, argumentative writing, not creative writing, although some of our arguments we think apply to creative writing as well. But come right down to it, we agreed that, and we started telling students this, if you can summarize what you're reading in a recognizable way, in a way that others who read it can recognize that you're summarizing the text accurately, and if you can do that and then use your summary to set up your own argument, you're going to become a good argumentative writer. And as we discussed this practice of summary and response, this is sort of the bottom line. This is the one big thing that you have to do in order to write good academic essays, but also good op-ed articles, letters to the editor, legal reports, and so forth. Summarize what they say and use that to set up what I say. And that discussion helped us generate the title, They Say, I Say. And we started experimenting with this kind of simplification. In other words, the process needed to be simplified. And this was basically the germ of what eventually became the textbook.
I remember that at about the same time, I had my first teaching job in Chicago. And I was so excited to teach, you know, and it was a teaching of writing position, teaching first year composition. And I was so pumped to teach because not only did I myself enjoy writing, but it is the lingua franca of academic culture. Writing is the central way we assess students' thinking, how well they're understanding the subject, how well they can assimilate the material they're being exposed to. And it's widely agreed to be the sort of central vehicle through which academics communicate, obviously. Some people argue the most important course in all of higher education, and K-12 as well. But I remember that the first-year writing office at the university I was teaching at had a big bookshelf with all of the textbooks that we could choose from in order to teach first-year writing. And the faculty would sort of look through them and decide whatever textbook they wanted to use in their course. And I got there early, you know, in the middle of the summer, and I was all, you know, going to be totally prepared with a textbook for the fall. And I would take down these sort of 5 to 10 pound tomes from the bookshelf, and they were so heavy. And I would take like 4 or 5 home a night, and I would look through them. And each one was, as Jerry said, too much information. It was just over categorization of all the different skills that go into academic writing, too much detail, too many different types of writing, differences between argumentative writing and persuasive writing, and writing to explain and writing to expose and writing for social justice, and all these different types. And each you could just look through the table of contents and see that this was really not going to teach students the central skill of academic culture. So I'd lug back the big books, and I'd almost be breaking my back, you know, carrying them in and out of the car and getting them back to the university office. I'd take back another 5 or 10 books. I couldn't find anything. And earlier I had taken Gerald's course on Introduction to Graduate Studies at Northwestern, which had transformed my life. And his mantra in the class, he had a mantra, which is just having a mantra sort of starts to simplify. You can always already see us moving in the simplification mode. Regardless of what the mantra was, to have a writing mantra for the class was kind of revolutionary. And his mantra was, enter the conversation. And since he was known, as Bob, you pointed out, for debate, that really meant enter the debates, stage the debate in your writing, and take a position within it, or summarize what somebody you mostly disagree with has said and disagree with it, or even somebody you think needs to be reinforced, so or agree. That was sort of the model. And I remember thinking those students really just need that basic model, even at the undergraduate level, not just for graduate school. Jerry and I talked about it. We thought it would also help for K-12 education. And that's sort of how we came up with that was some of the central germs of the book.
When I read about Jerry's background, it became so obvious to me the connection between teach the conflict, which means enter the conversation, make your own argument about anything that's maybe controversial, and the book, They Say, I Say. The They Say, I want to point out, that They Say is prominent, that's first. Now, most people reverse that, I would guess, in their writing. They come out with their own opinions, and then they put in other opinions that oppose their opinions. But you're making it prominent and obvious to people that all conversations are built on previous thoughts and ideas and conversations. So we'll get into that a little bit more. The subtitle of your book is The Moves That Matter in Academic Writing. Tell folks, what's the difference between academic writing and other forms of writing? You already mentioned some other forms of writing. And then give us some examples. Not a bunch of examples, because they can get that book and you have a full list of all the examples in there. But give us some examples, just so people anchor that and know what you're talking about as the moves that matter.
You asked about the word academic. Why the moves that matter in academic writing? How is academic writing special or different? Actually, the word academic in our title was a publisher's decision, a marketing decision. The big market for textbooks of our kind is first-year composition courses and also other academic courses, especially in college and also in K-12. We would have preferred the book to be titled something like The Moves That Matter in Argumentative Writing or Persuasive Writing or something like that. But I think our publisher was right. The book has sold over 3 million copies in almost 20 years now. If we hadn't had the word academic in the title, it probably wouldn't have, because the word is angled toward the big market. But consequently, our book doesn't get into Barnes & Noble frequently. Somebody said that's because that word academic is in the title. So that's maybe unfortunate, maybe not. In fact, there shouldn't be a great deal of difference between academic and non-academic writing, although one would be obvious. If you're writing in the field of biology or the field of mathematics or political science, you're addressing issues in that field, and you're possibly also using an academic vocabulary, some degree of academic jargon. So that would be one obvious difference. I make the case in my book, Clueless in Academe, that academia and journalism have becoming much closer together than they ever were. I think this began in the 60s, and there's complicated reasons for this. But now when you have, when a crisis develops like 9/11, immediately courses and even programs get generated, academic courses and programs get generated. And the line between journalistic writing and academic writing, especially the op-ed page and the academic article, has become blurred. If you open up the daily paper, a lot of the writing on the op-ed page is going to be by academics. And we assign a good deal of writing by journalists. George Orwell and other writers, popular writers, have long been on the reading list for writing courses. So I hope that's a clear example to your question. There are differences between, quote, academic and non-academic writing, but they have become, I think, less and less pronounced and less obvious. And in many ways, our book is simply about how to write for real-world audiences, whether they're academics or not.
It's interesting that you highlighted the subtitle, The Moves That Matter in Academic Writing. Jerry just pointed out the misleading nature of one of those words, academic, but there's another misleading word. You got to watch your words. I mean, writing, you know, even when you spend, you know, 2 years figuring out your title, no word is absolutely perfect all the time. The word moves, plural, is also a little bit misleading because we believe that there are a lot of moves of academic writing, turns of phrase, types of takings of positions and so forth in academic writing, but there's one big move. And the one big move, sort of grand poobah, the fish that eats all the other fish, the biggest fish of them all, is the they say, I say move that forms the title proper of the textbook. And it's the basic format of that move is something like, you know, author X argues blah, blah, blah. But my own view is blah, blah, blah. What we're trying to do is sort of simplify all the complexities of academic culture and language down to its ultimate essence. Some people have called it the internal DNA of academic discourse. And I think that's very aptly put. And that is the sort of central germ for us. There are other moves. You asked us to identify some of those moves. Some of them are things like on the one hand, on the other hand. If you don't have that formulation in your toolkit as an academic, you're not going to get very far. And probably even in public journalistic culture as well, it's a really important way of, on the one hand, Trump does have a point about da-da-da. On the other hand, he needs to sort of rethink da-da-da. Or you could reverse, you know, the evaluation. So that's one. Something like, even something as simple as author X argues. A lot of our students don't exactly come in knowing that move. They'll just sort of launch into what author X argues without explaining that the sentence is a description of what author X argues, not their own view. So just framing a sentence or a claim as something said by author X is very helpful for students, and it's actually essential to help the reader understand who's saying what in a given text, what is being asserted. So those are just some of the moves. But again, we can't emphasize enough that there's one big simplifying move that encompasses it all. And that's they say, I say.
Another big move would be, we call it planting a naysayer in your text, introducing a counter argument. At this point, you know, as you're writing an essay, at this point, you will probably want to disagree, or you will want to attack me, or at this point, I may seem to be outrageous when I say and so forth. You anticipate the objection. Another big move would be what we call meta commentary. We argue that in every argumentative text, there are really two texts. One in which you make your argument, and the other in which you try to anticipate misunderstandings and manage your reader's response to it. So you would say, so far I've been arguing blah, 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 but please don't misunderstand me to be saying blah, blah, blah. I'm making a version of that point, but not, you know, here's the difference and so forth.
Let me interject one more and then let's move on. I want a little cliffhanger effect here so folks are motivated to go out and get that book, because there's a lot of things that I hadn't thought about until I read that book that are really important to include in any kind of an argument. As I'll point out later, the book, to me, is not just about academic writing. It's about entering the conversation, whether you're doing it on an academic basis, a friendly verbal conversation with a family member. And that's why I think it's very appropriate for our show, because we're not a show on education, but we're a show on thinking. And this book is not only a book on writing, it's a book on thinking. But the one I do want to add that you point out in your book is why it matters. Why is this important? Why should you listen to this? Why should you read this? That's a key element that I think is left out a lot that's very important.
We have a chapter called So What and Who Cares? That's one of our moves, you know, explaining why it matters. There are some subjects that invite that question, you know, when you feel you're going off on a point and it's not clear why you're talking about it, stop and say, I have to underscore this point because, then explain it.
In the preface of your book, They Say, I Say, you explain that the book aims to, and this is a quote, demystify academic writing by isolating its basic moves, explaining them clearly, and representing them in the form of templates. And we just talked about some of those aspects. Can you elaborate a little more on this for us? Maybe give an example of a template, what is kind of meant by that, and explain why you believe it's necessary to offer extensive, explicitly written templates throughout the book.
The templates originated from an experience that I think we both saw the need as teachers to simplify for students and give them some of the language of academic culture, of academic argument. When I was first starting to teach again at, in different schools around Chicago, first year writing, it was actually a real formative experience for me was in a literature class. I was teaching some American novels, and we were talking about tensions in the literary works, how the author seemed to imply, on the one hand, what on the other hand they seemed to contradict. And we were talking about these tensions and seeming contradictions in the novels. And I had some wonderful class discussions about this. And the final assignment that grew out of these discussions and these readings was to write about these contradictions in literary works. And my students turned in their papers and not one single student used the word contradiction. Not one single student used the phrase, on the one hand, blah, 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 on the other hand, blah, blah, blah. And I couldn't make heads or tails of what they were saying. It was sort of hard to make sense of it. And so I said, you know what, we got to redo these essays, you got to rewrite them. And I came into class and I just sketched on the chalkboard some of the language I wanted them to use. Just go home and use this phrase, on the one hand, on the other hand, or author X tries to have it both ways. At the same time, she argues blah, blah, blah. She also argues blah, blah, blah. I gave them kind of a scaffolding or a structure. We call it a template, a fill-in-the-blank format for structuring their own arguments. And the papers that came back the next week were so much better. They weren't perfect. They still needed a lot of work, but they were so much better. And Jerry and I, we were sort of putting our thoughts together on this textbook that we wanted to write. And we realized that these templates could play a pivotal role, make actionable, helping students put into practice the sort of theory that Jerry had in his first year introduction to graduate studies course that I had taken of enter the conversation, enter the debate, stage the debate and enter it. And we eventually came up with the ultimate move for entering a debate is they say, I say, and that became, again, the sort of master template.
I think we realized that, and I think Kathy's story illustrates this, that many students, probably most students, will never make certain moves in their writing if you just preach to them as a teacher that you should do this. Because, first of all, they've not made these moves, and we don't grow up making them. How many of us grew up using a formula like, well, at this point, you're probably going to object that blah, blah, blah. You know, you'd sound stilted if you, most kids in conversation or even adult conversation, it's not a way to become popular if you use these formulas, these writing formulas. And so we realized that most of our students were never going to generate a phrase or even like Kathy mentioned, I argue that, which sounds stiff and formal, but it's, you can't leave home without it if you can't use some version of that formula. So underlying this whole, the templates is the notion that writing fundamentally is formulaic or communication is formulaic. You and I didn't invent the phrase, hello, how are you? It's a formula. And this gets us into a certain kind of controversy itself because kind of a mantra of writing instructions that all formulas are bad. And we can see why this evolved, because a lot of formulas used to teach writing are, we think, bad or at least imperfect. For example, the five-paragraph theme. In other words, a certain number of bad formulas gave the use of formulas in teaching writing a bad name. We've gotten some flack for using templates from the writing community, the academic writing community instructors. Problem is, as we argue, if you don't give students these formulas, which really just show them what it looks like instead of telling them to do stuff, if you don't show them what it looks like, very few of them will do it.
I agree with that completely. And to relate this to critical thinking, I don't look at those templates as writing prompts. I look at them as thinking prompts. They are suggestions for, have you thought about including this? If I were to use them, I wouldn't use them word for word. I would just use them as reminders, and then I would put them in my own words, and it wouldn't be a template. It would come from me, but it's a reminder. I'm not doing academic writing, but I am trying to teach people how to do critical thinking. In critical thinking, it's very important to include those things that you call moves and have written templates for. And you do mention critical thinking several times in your book. For instance, in the introduction, and this is a quote from your book, "Ultimately, this book invites you to become a critical thinker who can enter into the types of conversations described eloquently by the philosopher Kenneth Burke." There's a little more to that sentence, but we don't need the rest of it. So give us your views on what critical thinking is, as well as its importance and value in our society.
We think that the emergence of the phrase critical thinking and the kind of consensus that critical thinking is really what it's all about when it comes to being a good student or a successful citizen or society, a good professional. It's very encouraging and promising that critical thinking has emerged as kind of the central phrase. As I say, there's a kind of emerging consensus inside and outside academia about the centrality of critical thinking. But we also think that one problem with the phrase is that, again, a lot of students don't know what it means. When our son was 10 years old, or maybe even now, I don't think he had any sense of what critical thinking meant. But if you said, well, it's all about argument, about entering into debates and being able to summarize what's going on and make your own, I say, move, I think then it becomes much clearer to students. So we think that it's helpful to take a phrase like critical thinking and translate it into something like make an argument, enter the conversation, play the game of they say, I say. Because as I say, the term is somewhat nebulous to people who don't already get it. So a part of our project is to introduce, is to somewhat displace the language and shift the emphasis to argument, enter the conversation, enter the debate.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes one useful way of thinking about teaching is sort of an ability to simplify a complex body of material for people who've never been exposed to that complex body of material. And Jerry and I, in some ways, are trying to do that. This word simplification, I think it comes up a lot in this discussion so far. Trying to do that for academic writing, trying to crystallize it down. So critical thinking means a lot of different things to a lot of different people throughout academic culture. In different departments, it often means different things. With different courses, it means different things. Sometimes each different faculty member will have their own unique view of what critical thinking entails. And for us, we're just trying to sort of whittle it down to academic argument, making an argument. And then furthermore, we try and whittle that down to the process of they say, I say, summarizing what others think and then responding to it. And if I just may mention one more thing, this quote from Kenneth Burke is absolutely invaluable. Do you mind if I were to read a little bit of it and just make a comment?
Go ahead.
Okay. Here's the passage, and this is cited widely throughout the field of first-year composition. Scholars in our field absolutely love this quotation. It's a kind of a gem that nobody's ever really attacked, and everybody is always invoking to explain what they're doing. You come late. When you arrive, it's just, you're entering a party. You're coming to some sort of a parlor where a party is underway. You come late. When you arrive, others have long preceded you, and they are engaged in a discussion too heated for them to pause and tell you exactly what it is about. You listen for a while until you decide that you have caught the tenor of the argument. Then you put in your oar. Someone answers, you answer him. Another comes to your defense. Another aligns himself against you. And what Jerry and I try to find in this passage that's almost a cliche at this point in the field of writing studies is that it's actually a recipe. You enter a conversation, you listen, you spend a lot of time just listening, trying to understand it until you can finally catch the gist and the tenor of it. That's step one. Number two, you put in your own oar. Someone answers you, there's a counter argument, maybe even agreement, and you answer them in return. It's a dialogue. It's almost a debate, but really more of a conversation is a sort of broader way of thinking about it. You're aligned with certain people, as Kenneth Burke says, and you align yourself against certain people and vice versa, them towards you. It's kind of the story of culture and history. And we're asking students to sort of, we're trying to show students in a sort of simple recipe-like way how to enter into that stream of conversation that some people describe, we think amorphously, as critical thinking, but we try to, again, whittle down to conversation.
Could I add something here? At this point, you might object that, well, yes, of course, enter the conversation, make an argument, summarize others. Isn't that so obvious? You know, why are you telling us this? Isn't this so obvious that it needn't be said? Well, actually, the answer is no. If you look at how writing has been taught and is still taught widely in K-12 and sometimes in college as well, students have been told not to, I think, Bob, you referred to this at the beginning, or maybe when we were chatting before program, students have been told to say smart things, make a good argument, find a topic that interests you, and make an argument about it, and marshal a lot of evidence to back up your argument. That sounds like good advice. In some ways it is, but the problem is that it's very hard to launch an argument in isolation, in a vacuum. A good way to generate very boring writing is to tell people to, you know, just make an argument in a vacuum. The problem, and we say this in the book, in the introduction to the book, if you don't frame your own argument with a summary of the conversation or with what somebody else is saying, what you say may be clear, but why you're saying it won't be. You know, people say, why are you telling me this? The answer is, well, I need to tell you this because most people these days tend to think blah, blah, blah. Or I used to think blah, 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 but now I realize blah, blah, blah. So enter the conversation may sound like an obvious, as Kathy said, it's kind of a cliche, but a lot of students, a lot of writing instruction proceeds without recognizing the importance of that. We call it monological instruction. One of our projects is to try to reorient writing instruction, especially in K-12. I think there's a reason why they say, I say, had not been the dominant model for writing instruction, because it's a little harder. Students have come up to me and said, well, do I really have to summarize this whole debate? You know, it's intimidating. The debate often isn't framed very clearly for you, and you have to figure out what it is, and then you may not have the language for framing a debate on the one hand, on the other hand, as Kathy was saying. So I think a lot of writing instruction is preceded on the premise that it's too hard for students to enter the conversation. Students are smart. Let them just show how smart they are by saying smart things in isolation. We think that's really making writing a lot harder in the long run.
The thing that's going on in my mind as you're talking about that quote that Kathy read is that the setting there is you're having a conversation with other people and they're going to express their ideas. But if you're writing an academic paper or if you're on a podcast giving your opinions about things and talking about issues, it's one-sided. Your communication is going out, but that other side of the conversation is going on in their minds. In other words, as you're prompting and giving your argument, people can't help themselves but think of the counter argument or think of how they feel about it. So it's going on anyway. So you're just acknowledging it. So, you know, that's the importance that I see there. We don't have time to talk about the state of critical thinking in our country right now and in the world, but we talk a lot about that on this program anyway. But we'll move on and get into some of the details and nuances that we haven't talked about.
One of the things I was thinking was, if it was that obvious, that would these methods were that obvious, that it would be reflected in the quality of our conversations these days. And I think a lot of us are looking for ways to improve the quality of those conversations. I really like the framing of entering the conversation because, as you said, many of these ideas and some of maybe our most important ideas of modernity have been ongoing conversations that started long before we entered the conversation. So coming back to the beginning of your book, They Say, I Say, the first three chapters describe the importance of entering the conversation by starting with what others are saying, and additionally by learning the art of summarizing and the art of quoting. Could you describe what you mean by entering the conversation? We've used that turn of phrase a number of times now, but maybe expanding on what we mean by entering the conversation and help our listeners understand a little more the key points in those first three chapters, why they are so foundational when it comes to entering the conversation.
To sort of to combine the two concerns you just raised, which is the state of public discourse and the issue of listening, starting with what others are saying, quoting, just to combine those two concerns. One way you can describe the hyperpolarization that of the era in which we're now living is as everybody's sort of inhabiting non-communicating echo chambers, that there's two sort of basic conversations going on in the culture right now, and never the two shall meet. The Trump people are talking to other Trumpers, and everybody else is talking to everybody else. And there's not a lot of communication between the two. Solving this problem is incredibly complex and probably something we couldn't even begin to get into. This is just one little point I'm going to make about that, this kind of polarization. The problem with that polarization is that people might be addressing what others are saying, but it's often within their echo chamber. And when people do venture outside of their echo chamber, the way, and this is not always true, and I think one side is a little more guilty of this than the other, so I don't want to pretend like this is equal sidesism, but when we do tend to venture outside of our echo chambers, we tend to caricature the counterview or those outside of our in-group. And I think part of our model of enter the conversation, start with what others are saying, engage in a lot of summary. And by summary, we mean summary where you really play the believing game. You really try and stand in the shoes of the person who you're summarizing. And instead of just scapegoating them or caricaturing them, summarizing them in a way that others will recognize it as a summary, or they themselves will assent to it as a summary of them. if we were to get outside of our echo chambers and summarize each other more accurately, it might help. We noticed that on MSNBC, there's not a lot of time spent doing justice. Ari Melber's one show on MSNBC, he sometimes will bring in a conservative. I noticed Fareed Zakaria often brings in a counter view. He brought in a conservative today, and he opened by summarizing his own position, Fareed Zakaria did. And he started out with the conservative, and he said, I want to begin with you today on this panel. I want to hear what you think, because I know you're going to disagree with me. And he gave the guy a lot of time to respond back and forth. But that's rare to see somebody on MSNBC or CNN. Well, CNN tries to do it, but CNN sometimes is a shouting match. And suffice it to say that there's a connection between the state of our hyper-polarized, overly polarized culture today and the need to listen to the other side. And by other, we don't just mean any other side, the radical other, you know, the other as in those who disagree with you or really think that your ideas are vile. Summarizing people who want to laugh at you, who want to caricature, and whose views you think are vile, trying to really summarize them and set aside your sense of their vileness, at least temporarily, summarizing them at their best, not at their worst.
On this program, we've often talked about straw man arguments versus steel manning. What strikes me is just having good faith arguments. It seems that these days, you know, when it comes to even attempts to summarize, maybe not so much in like mainstream news and whatnot, but just in conversations with each other, that there isn't as much good faith attempts in trying to summarize where somebody else is coming from. And that can be a really difficult exercise at times, especially like we perceive the other person to be, you know, harmful or vile.
One might want to laugh at them. I mean, comedians are always doing this. They're always sort of summarizing somebody very briefly, but summarizing them in a way that shows their ridiculousness. That actually can be a way of bringing out and exposing what they're saying in a new light and shedding new light on it, even if it makes it look even more ridiculous. So it's complicated how to really do justice to what someone else is saying.
The details about the importance of and the techniques involved for summarizing and the art of quoting, we're probably going to have to refer to your book and recommend the book to get some of those details. There's so much more to talk about here. We're recommending it as a book for critical thinking and people that follow this show. There are also details in the book about how to then make that transition and express your own views and using personal stories, a lot of really valuable information. But I want to move to something that been of interest to me for a long time, and that's the connection between writing and thinking. I want to get your views on this. And let me give you a personal story that goes along with this, because this anecdote of what happened to me is what started me probably first thinking about the relationship of writing and thinking. It takes place, I was an undergraduate chemistry major, and I did have to take English 101. So I asked around, I wanted to find a professor that was interesting and iconoclastic and provocative. And as it turned out, the professor that fit the bill there, and I really loved the class. And I contributed a lot in the class. I really had a lot of thoughts about what Professor Henkel was talking about. And as was his policy, on the last day, he dismissed us early, but he returned our final paper for the course with the grade on the paper and the grade that we got in the course. Before I got the paper back, I was anticipating an A. I was thinking, I aced this course. I had a lot of ideas, and I resonated very well with the professor. So I visibly squirmed in my seat when I saw a big, bold B as a course grade in English 101. Most of the students accepted the grade and they left, but I joined the line with the other grade grubbers and waiting for our opportunities to convince the professor or at least, you know, defend the grade in some way. And he looked at me and he said, Bob, I very much enjoyed your comments in the class, but I gave you a B because your thinking deserved an A, but your writing, according to my standards, was a C. And then before I could even respond to that, he said, next student. So, you know, that got me to thinking afterwards, wait a minute now, writing and thinking, what's the relationship to writing and thinking? So I want to throw that out there. It's kind of philosophical, but what can you do with that?
The quick answer I would give is that you don't really know what you think until you articulate it, not necessarily write it, but articulate it in language. And this is a premise of a lot of writing instruction, that you discover what you think only when you try to articulate it in either orally or in writing. Why you only got a B for writing and A for thinking, I guess, might suggest that you would have been even better in your articulation had you worked more on translating that into your writing and then letting your writing refine your thinking.
Or it could mean, what I was thinking it could mean, is that you were very good in conversation, but since writing is often presented as a monological, non-dialogical, non-conversational act, your writing wasn't as strong because you didn't have the interlocutors to play off of. And which is what, it's the interlocutors in our view that really give your writing its point and make it sing and make it shine.
Well, yeah,
and
that suggests a comeback you could have made, which is, well, your writing assignments were not dialogical or not conversational. you just asked me what I thought.
Yeah.
If you had asked me to enter a debate in my writing, it would have gotten a lot better.
Or just to summarize an author and then respond, agree or disagree. Simple, something like that.
Could have helped him.
I couldn't think fast enough. I should have written a note to him.
Well, now you can send him our book say. Yeah,
well, our book wasn't published then.
Yeah, so it's not, nobody's fault. I've had students exactly like what you were. I've had one or two. It's rare, though, because generally, Jerry and I tend to believe that writing and thinking are connected at the hip. I mean, of course, somebody could just think something smart and just dash it off poorly. But 9 times out of 10, we think that the writing moves generate the thought rather than reflect the thought. In other words, students don't walk around like with brilliant ideas about things necessarily, although they might. They're sort of half-baked and it's sort of cooking up there with a whole bunch of other things floating. But once you try and write it, it forces you to really figure out what you think. There are certain connections that might be illogical just floating around there, but you don't really challenge them because you're not forced to put pen to paper and look at them in the light of day on a piece of paper. So our thoughts might seem really terrific, but it's the writing itself that a phrase like, my point is not X, but Y. Asking students to fill that out can really illuminate them. Oh, I'm not making the usual point that people make. I'm trying to say a point somewhat different. Or something like, at this point, you will object that, blah, 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 but my own view is blah, blah, blah. That can really help students refine their position and give more nuance to it and qualify what, which was something that was otherwise sort of an unqualified, overly vague stance that they were taking. So we see writing as creating thinking, not simply reflecting a prior series of thoughts, and that good writing templates can actually generate better thinking.
There's another complication here too, that writing helps you discover, or necessary if you discover what you think. But often, and this varies from person to person, writer to writer, writing to a real audience often makes you think better than writing in a solitary room. I'll tell you one experience of mine. When I was first invited to give an academic lecture, I worked very hard on it. It was at a college that I was visiting. And when I took my text out, I worked very hard on it. I thought it was really good stuff. When I took the text out, my draft out, the night before I was to give it, I was horrified. It sounded smart to me when I was writing it, but there was not a real audience. I had an imagined audience. But the realization that I had to read this stuff to real people, I hoped, who would show up sitting in front of me the next day, threw me into a panic. I realized they'd never be able to understand it. The sentences were way too long. There was subordinate clause on top of subordinate clause. I had 5 different thoughts within a paragraph. Forget it. Nobody's going to be able to get it when you're reading it to them. And I feverishly rewrote the paper, rewrote the whole thing. And from then on, I always tried to think of a real audience. But also, I noticed too that when I am writing something that's giving me a problem, and then I'll go back to my email correspondence and I'll try to re-explain to my correspondent what I'm trying to say, I always do it better. I simplify it because the real audience, I'm writing to a real person who forces me to make sense. So there's a couple of points there. You need to write it in order to know what you think, and you probably need a real audience in order to really discover how you want to say it and what you think. Hope that's clear.
Yeah, that was very helpful. We're getting towards the end of the show, so I'm going to come at you guys with a pretty hot topic, just while we only have a few minutes to address it. As with many tools, there are upsides and downsides about the role of artificial intelligence in education. And one of the new chapters in your latest 6th edition of They Say, I Say, the new chapter is titled, When Your They Say is a Bot. What are your experiences with the use of AI in writing classes and in education?
Well, one of the things we're going to do in our 7th edition, which we're beginning to think about right now, is try and address AI not simply in one isolated chapter, but to really make it much more of a core issue throughout the entire book, make it a more global issue, because the impact of AI on academia can't be overestimated. We have colleagues who just say it's simply destroyed teaching. To remind you of something I said at the beginning about the centrality of writing as an assessment tool in academic culture and as the central communication tool, it's impossible to assess a student's thinking if you can't tell if they wrote it. And it's very tempting for students to just plug in an assignment into ChatGPT, for instance, and hand it in. ChatGPT's kind of miraculous what it can do. It's unbelievable, its power. They can come up with amazing material. It's fantastic. And it's very hard to catch students doing that. So we try to take the attitude, if you can't beat it, join it. And I think most faculty are trying to do that, trying to figure out how to do that. And that's what we try and do in our chapter.
One thing that we might want to do, everybody sermonizes to students, you know, and a lot of students accept this, you know, well, look, if you cheat by letting ChatGPT write your paper, you're cheating yourself, ultimately. You might get away with it, but
you're not building your intellectual muscle and your rhetorical muscle upstairs, and it'll atrophy, and you're in school precisely to develop that muscle.
But when push comes to shove, a lot of students, you know, when crunch time comes, I've got to get this paper in, they will give in to the temptation, as we all would, you know, come on. Let AI write the paper for me. And one thing that we might emphasize, and we do this somewhat in our own chapter that you referred to, your students need to realize that ChatGPT makes a lot of mistakes. And that if you trust it to write your paper, there's a good chance that it's going to embarrass you by, for example, making up fake sources, which it does. We were kind of shocked. To write our chapter, we fed ChatGPT and other AI outlets. We fed it questions where we thought we had a pretty good idea of the answer. And for example, in one example that we cite, it cited a real author, a New York Times writer. We tried to look up that author. We couldn't find the article. So we said, again, to ChatGPT, where's this article? Oh, I'm sorry, I invented it. It was the sort of thing I thought that the author would say, rather than he really said, I invented the source. Well, if a student does that and is caught, it's going to be very embarrassing. Even more deeper level, we found that when you fed ChatGPT a question that was really tricky and difficult, it often flubbed it and gave a fake answer. For example, I found a sentence in one of my own essay, Hidden Intellectualism, that's in the book, at the end of the book. One of the more complicated ideas that I was expressing, and I fed that, I said, what does Gerald Graff mean when he wrote blah, blah, blah? And ChatGPT came back with a very plausible answer. I mean, an answer that sounded pretty good, but was just totally wrong. And so I then followed up by saying, well, I'm afraid you're wrong. That's not what Graff meant. And then I got back an apology, you know, and I corrected it. So students need to realize that at a certain level of sophistication, AI will, now maybe this has been refined since then, and maybe this is no longer a problem, but we suspect that this is a limitation. That so far, maybe the best argument we can make for not over-relying on ChatGPT.
My response is, now I'm going to have to buy Edition 7, because that is so interesting. I had more to say about that, but we're out of time. There's so many more questions. Maybe someday we'll do a part two of this. But Gerald Graff and Kathy Berkenstein-Graff, thank you so much for taking the time with us on Thinking Clearly to share your deep thinking and information about writing and effective communication in general, and for offering to the world that specific guide for doing just that, a book with the title of They Say, I Say. On our Facebook page, we're going to link to Gerald's personal website, which is geraldgraff.com, GeraldGraff.com, and to the book, They Say, I Say. Are there any other links that you'd like us to post?
Julia mentioned that your show is not just for students. That's very important to us, that we try to get out to an audience wider than students. So I think you're helping us greatly to do that. Thank you.
Thank you both. And I always like to give a shout out to our listeners. Thank you so much for making contact with us. tc@kmud.org is our email for that. And as always, Julia, thank you.
Thanks, Bob.
So until next time, keep thinking
clearly.